This week on Making Contact.
How come we're the number one arms seller and arms gifter in the whole world? We're training soldiers and police from 150 countries around the world.
I think women's rights are like any part of a human rights. They are universal, they are indivisible.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. On this program, we profile four courageous women. Laura Slattery left a career in the United States military to become a nonviolent activist against militarism. Ahmed Badran spearheads a Palestinian-Israeli feminist peace coalition. Paula Green brings conflict transformation worldwide to the victims of war. And Hyun-Bak Chung heads a South Korean effort to mediate peace between the United States and North Korea. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Laura Slattery graduated West Point Military Academy with the rank of lieutenant. She embraced nonviolent activism when she learned about the United States' deep involvement in the political turmoil of Latin America. She's gone to prison for protesting the U.S. training of Latin American soldiers at Fort Benning, Georgia. Laura now works as international coordinator of Pachabene's program, From Violence to Wholeness.
I never really had any aspiration to be in the military. I'm a senior in high school. I want to play sports, right? I'm not very good. West Point's recruiting me to play basketball. I'm fifth of six kids. There's not a lot of money. My mom's raising us by herself. It's a full scholarship. I was planning on going to medical school when I got out of West Point. And so the whole military aspect never really appealed to me very much, actually. It kind of made it more palatable to think that I was going to be a doctor in the military, helping people as opposed to harming people. Something about the West Point experience creates feminists, I think, spending that much time with all those men in those situations. It just kind of dawns on you, like, well, that's not really right. They kind of get in your face and say things like, you better not get fat, Slattery, and don't be like the other women here. You better keep up. And then you start to look back and say, they're trying to turn us against our fellow women. And oftentimes, the women who can keep up do separate themselves from the other women. It's like, because I can make the run, you know, or I can do as many push-ups as the other guys or whatever. So if the other women can't, then I'm going to separate myself from them because I'm going to jump on with the folks who are making it. I think that was perhaps one of the reasons I was successful, because I wasn't really in touch with my heart and my feelings.
Laura finished her military service after the first Gulf War, gave up the idea of medical school, and looked for a deeper calling. She returned to her Catholic roots.
And so I went to go live in Mexico at a house of Annunciation House called Casa del Peregrino. I remember showing up and I didn't speak a word of Spanish. And they said, oh, you'll learn. Oh, my gosh. And it was there living for 8 months with fellow Catholics who had radically different views on things than I did. They had protested the war. Here I had been in, I had volunteered to go to the war, and I had no idea that anybody had protested or anyone felt any differently than I had felt. So it's a real lack of awareness, I think, of other opinions on the world, in the world scene. And from there, I decided a friend of mine was going down to El Salvador. So I went down to El Salvador with her and spent 6 months living in a village called Tenancingo that had been particularly hard hit by their civil war. Before I had gone down, I hadn't even realized that the United States was involved in the 12-year civil war. How I can be in the military for 7 years and not even realize that our military is involved in El Salvador befuddles me, really, to look back at that. But that is the case. And it turns out, in Tenancingo, that was the first place where the Salvadorans used U.S. helicopters. They came in and strafed the entire town, killing about 200 of the civilians and causing the town to be in exile for 3 years. There was no one living there, which really blew me away when I came back to the United States and I started reading more about our involvement in the Civil War there. At the height of our involvement, we were sending $1 million a day in military aid there. And this is some of my connection to the School of the Americas, is that we were training the soldiers who, and I don't want to say we were training the death squads, but we were training the soldiers who then oftentimes when they got out of the military would enter these death squads. The soldiers would support the death squads who would take out and torture the people. I mean, the stories I heard from the people there about what they had seen, it was really just too much to even take in.
Sending soldiers to distant places, X's and O's on someone's drawing board.
Laura was moved to join the School of the Americas Watch, a nationwide effort to close down the infamous training camp for Latin American militaries, now renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security and Cooperation.
For 50 years, we've run this school. And it's got the reputation throughout Latin America of a school of assassins. There are people on tape who have confessed, I guess you could say, or have acknowledged that they received torture training at the School of the Americas. And also there were manuals found at the school. People call them torture manuals. Well, there was a couple of lines in there that advocated blackmail and torture and extortion and extrajudicial killings. The school likes to downplay those and say, oh, you know, but they were barely used. But the fact that they were in there and no one caught that, they said, oh, it was outdated training. Okay, so it's outdated training material, but so were we training in that way, you know, 10, 15 years ago? And who are we now then to be the human rights teachers? It's bigger than the School of the Americas. It's about the our foreign policy as a whole. How come we're the number one arms seller and arms gifter in the whole world? There was a recent report that came out from Amnesty International that said that we're training soldiers and police from 150 countries around the world. That's one of my biggest issues, is why, and why don't we see that? And how can we still then wear the white hat and say, We're the number one leaders in democracy when we're training 150 countries around the world in how to better kill. Yeah. There's a cultural myth, I'll call it, of this redemptive violence in our society that says something good will come out of when we use violence to destroy those who are doing evil. Or even worse, said those who are evil. That some sort of good will come out of that. And I think this is, in my work in nonviolence, this is what I'm really trying to work on, is that it's that us-them dichotomy. It's that idea that the myth of redemptive violence doesn't work.
First it was a question, then it was a mission. How to be American, how to be a Christian.
Amneh Badran, a Palestinian feminist, joined the Jerusalem Center for Women in 1997 to work for Palestinian women's rights. The center also works in coalition with their Israeli counterpart, Bat Shalom. Together, they brave the dangers and complexities in the quest for peace in the Middle East.
Jerusalem Center for Women is also a coalition of women who represent political parties who support the Oslo Accord, plus independent and academic women. On a daily basis, I'm trying to manage a women's center that has 5 staff members. We're trying to develop a network of friends and allies from the peace movements all over the world. And lobby for just peace. We are trying to do programs for women empowerment and to recruit them in the women peace movement. We're trying to develop women capacity buildings in different aspects, from human rights to advocacy, and we are t- we we write statements and letters, and we publish them and all of that. The partners of Jerusalem Center for Women are the women of Bat Shalom. Bat Shalom is an Israeli peace organization, and it represents a coalition of women who belong from labor to Hadash. The political message of the project is loaded with with a lot of political meanings. Plus, I'm doing it with an Israeli partner, and it's the first time that I'm speaking with an Israeli peace activist, an Israeli at all. I know the Israeli as a soldier. I know it as a policeman. I know them as tax collectors or those who make your life hell while waiting at the Interior Ministry to get a certificate or to get an ID card or something. But I didn't have encountered peace activists, whether Zionist, non-Zionist, or anti-Zionist. It was my first encounter with Israelis. It's once you deal with the other, and the other is coming from the position, from the other side, from the side of the occupier, even though she's a peace activist, but there is an asymmetry of power that you cannot ignore, and there are facts on the ground that you cannot ignore. The first question that comes to one's mind is, can I believe what she is saying? So it's the issue of trust, and the issue if there is a hidden agenda always comes to one's mind. And this is the case, I think, in every relation across divides between in a conflict area. For me, I just to feel not to personalize things very much, and not to get involved personally in the process and feel myself as if I'm normalizing socially and normalizing politically with occupation. And not to feel also at the same time that I will be misused by the other. Because you are always afraid that you will end up, in a way or another, misused by the other or by the media on the other side, or by the media on your side who would not be merciful towards you if you make a mistake. You cannot work with someone for years and then say, I didn't get involved personally. You're a human being. But at the end of the day, you cannot make the personal overcome the working relation. We are doing political work, and we have to reach the objective that we came to. We want to involve women in the process of peacemaking, and peacemaking means ending occupation with all its forms. One of the failures of the previous peace processes is the fact that neither women nor other sectors of civil societies on both sides have been involved in shaping the peace negotiations and the peace settlement. And this is why we feel that it is important to incorporate different sectors of civil society, including women, in any future negotiations.
The Jerusalem Center for Women and Bat Shalom went before the United Nations Security Council in 2002. They proposed an international women's commission to include Palestinian, Israeli, and international women at the Mideast negotiating table. And they urged the United Nations to intervene and protect civilians on both sides of the conflict.
I believe that I have, and the center has a mission to play, which is to promote the voice of peace and to work with friends and allies for justice, for ending occupation, and for the security of all. And this is a mission that someone has to be proud of. And over the years, I tend to become more and more proud of what we're doing. Women are doing something. Maybe at some point you feel that you are not influencing enough. You are not feeling the impact on your life and the other's life. But I think every step, every small step, if it's in the right direction, you will feel the fruits one day.
We'll hear more from the Women Rising series in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For CD or cassette copies of this Women's Desk program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Dr. Paula Green is a peace builder, a pioneer in the field of work developed in the 1990s as a response to the global rise of ethnic violence. Paula has worked in Rwanda, Sri Lanka, Israel and Palestine, Bosnia, and other conflict zones using intercommunal dialogue to bring people together and reweave communities.
I started a non-government organization about 10 years ago in Amherst, Massachusetts, where I live and work, and it's called Karuna Center, K-A-R-U-N-A. And Karuna is a word that means compassion or kindness, and it comes from the ancient languages of the Buddha. And in 1995, I was invited to start teaching at the School for International Training, which is a graduate program in Vermont. And so I also have an academic appointment, and my work there is to train the next generation of peace builders to encourage more people to do what I do. One of the interesting decisions that I made early on with my work is that I would only go where our organization receives an invitation, because I feel that as an American that I should not be putting myself in situations to work in other people's conflicts unless I've been invited. And over the years, through the spread of the internet and global communication, the invitations that I've received have multiplied pretty exponentially. Our largest project to date has been in northern Bosnia. We began in 1997, just 2 years after the end of the Bosnian War, and have been working there steadily ever since. Our work in Bosnia has been an extraordinary story. It had a very interesting beginning. In the beginning, in 1996, I received a phone call in my home in Massachusetts from a woman in a town called Sanski Most, Bosnia, which is in the northwest region of the country. This woman's name is Emsuda. She did not speak English. She had an interpreter on the phone with her, and she had heard about my work through someone else who had seen the work that Karuna Center does, and asked if we would come to Bosnia originally to help the Muslim women who were at that point recently resettled in Bosnia after being sent all over the world when they were expelled from their city in the Serb part of Bosnia in 1992. And I remember the first circle, I felt like we were just sitting around in the circle while people sobbed and told their stories and had the feedback from others that they were not alone, that all these stories were ones of tremendous devastation, and yet these women were exhibiting courage by carrying on with their lives and rebuilding families in a new home, a new situation, in a new part of Bosnia. At one point, they asked me if I would help them talk to the Serb women. That was very touching and very surprising to me, because the Serb women came from families that had committed violence against them. However, when I asked them why they wanted to meet the Serb women, they told me that the Serb women had been their friends, neighbors, colleagues, and in many cases relatives, because Bosnians were one-third intermarried before the war, which is a very high statistic. So they couldn't go into the Serbian part of Bosnia because there were NATO troops on the border, and it would have been very dangerous for them. But they said, Paula, you have an American passport. You should go. So I did. My translators and I went to the Serbian side of Bosnia, to a city called Prijedor, where our Muslims had previously lived before they were expelled. And very, very slowly, I identified some Serb women who were brave enough to come back across the border with me into the Muslim Croat side of Bosnia and participate in the first of these dialogues. The first time the Serb women came, only three showed up, actually, because the rest were, I think, too terrified, just 2 or 3 years after the end of a genocide, to enter the Muslim Federation from which many of them had left and through which there had been so much violence. So the first three came, and one of them was a nurse, and she was a very feisty young woman in her 20s or 30s. And she did a tremendous amount of reaching out and hugging and compassionate listening and really expressing her grief and shame at having been a bystander in this violence, unable to do any rescuing. And the first time that some of the Muslim women went back to see their destroyed houses on the Serb side, this woman came with us. And I remember one scene where we were standing in front of a totally blown up house that had belonged to one of our Muslim participants, and there were flowers growing through the cracks that had been a former garden. And this Serb woman picked the flowers and, with tears in her eyes, gave them to her Muslim colleague. And that, for me, was a stunning gesture of reconciliation. We had a wonderful experience with these women and they with each other, talking about their lives before the war, reflecting on the horrors that had happened during the war, and focusing on what they could do to heal and rebuild community. After that went on for about a year or two, and I was going three times a year to Bosnia at that point, the Serb and Muslim women said, "Paula, we want you to work with the educators." And I thought, well, I'm getting my marching orders again, aren't I? And I said, well, why should I work with the educators? And they said, well, because they're the key to the future of Bosnia. So at that point, I began a project called Project DIACOM, which stands for the Project on Dialogue and Community Building in Sanski Most and Prijedor. We had to get permission from the Ministries of Education, and we did, and we launched our Educators Inter-Ethnic Dialogue program, which is going on to this day.
University professor Hyun-Bak Chung came to the forefront of the South Korean women's movement as editor of its first feminist magazine, Women in Society. Her pioneering work on behalf of women brought her to a very personal confrontation with the South Korean government.
About 8 years ago, in this midnight, in front of my house, I was arrested by the 7 Korean CIA men. Can you imagine 7 men midnight in front of my house? And then in Korean CIA, I was interrogated almost 48 hours without sleeping. And then at that time, if I told really one sentence wrongly, probably I should be put into the prison at that time. This political oppression was so strong, and then at that time military dictatorship ruled the whole country. And then, for example, in my Department of History, the half of my colleagues went to the prison. They were dismissed from the university, and then some military violence at the campus is our everyday life.
Hyun-Bak's brutal first-hand experience with South Korea's military regime strengthened her commitment to democracy. She then joined the movement against the military's systematic prostitution of women.
We have had a lot of problems with the prostitution, but the prostitution is not only some kind of sexual relations, but also the many women in prostitution were beaten and also kidnapped. I heard from my students, many male students have to go to the military duties in Korean society. During these military duties, they were almost forced to go to the prostitution. The militarism is very closely connected also American U.S. Army bases in Korea. Since 1945, in surroundings of near to American military base, there were so many women for the prostitution. American soldiers has beaten these women terribly, and then several times also American soldiers murdered these women. In this case, Korean police cannot do something against this. 37,000 American soldiers are now in Korea, and also South Korea has almost 700,000 soldiers in the whole country.
Hyun-baek Chung spearheaded the effort to bring tough legislation against prostitution before the South Korean parliament. Her group, Korean Women's Association United, is now lobbying the United States to negotiate a peaceful relationship with North Korea.
Korean Women's Association United and also Women Making Peace. Women Making Peace is very active in peace-building works in South Korea. And we, both women's organizations, thought that we women should take a part in this peace-building work. At first, important thing is we should avoid the possible war on the Korean Peninsula. Therefore, we organized the committee for peace on the Korean Peninsula. This committee consists of 39 congressmen from both parties. It's very important, and governing party and the oppositional party, and also 75 very important NGO leaders. We bring some concrete suggestion to U.S. government and American civil societies. U.S. government can suggest some de facto non-aggression agreement to North Korea. And also, though, we demand U.S. government to abolish these economic sanctions against North Korea. In exchange for this non-aggression agreement, de facto non-aggression agreement, North Korea can dismantle their nuclear programs, and then morally we should bring peace in this world, to this world. And then I ask once again the American peace-loving women to work with us together in solidarity.
That's it for this women's edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Special thanks this week to Kimberly Ross for production assistance. Music from the Indigo Girls, Dar Williams, Kitka, and 4,000 Years of Korean Folk Music. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, director of production and training, Amy Pomerlo, office manager, Rosalind Fay, associate manager, Susanna Hines, senior advisor, Norman Solomon, national producer, David Barsamian. Peggy Law is our founding director, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.